Welcome to Living with Dying, a podcast where we're going to talk about the unspeakable, everything to do with death and dying, and how to live with it. We're all on the same journey towards the end, but we just never talk about it. We don't like to think of our own life ending, and we certainly don't like to contemplate losing our nearest and dearest. So we all join in this huge conspiracy, pretending it won't happen to us. And then, when it does, we're often ill-prepared. So we're saying, let's talk about death. Let's open up the subject, and by listening to other people's stories, glean some advice and tips on how best to approach death, how to deal with loss, and how to rebuild a life after. So I'm talking today for this episode to the founder of Poppy's Funeral Directors. And I noticed from your website, Poppy, that you say funerals need fresh thinking. And I'm wondering if you could tell me about that, please.
Yeah, of course. And I probably should expand it to say sort of death and dying need fresh thinking, in that I think we as a society have got a little bit lost when it comes to recognizing that death is a part of life. I think some of the fantastic, tremendous steps forward we've taken around healthcare and around, you know, there's lots of things that have improved hugely. And I think with that, we've lost our awareness that death, you know, it can be put off. You know, we can be healed from illnesses, and that's great. But it is coming to all of us, and that shouldn't feel like a sort of threatening, sort of grim reaper like axe hovering over our heads, I guess. Because if we consider death to be the enemy and death to be a failure, then that's just a very bad end, isn't it? When it is something that's so natural and so intrinsic to being human. And so my role, I guess, in this subject is, as you say, around funerals. So I founded Poppy's 10 years ago because I felt that funerals were inflexible and kind of outdated in their approach. I felt they weren't really serving grieving people. So it felt like they were very formulaic, you know, that you bought the gold package or the silver package or the bronze package. And what differentiated those packages was sort of one limousine or two limousines or three. And whilst, of course, we all need transport to get to the funeral, it just felt like we were prioritizing the wrong things. And so the whole thinking behind Poppy's is, you know, what would I want and need when my best people died? What kind of emotionally intelligent, professional, responsible people would I want around me helping me make good decisions? What kind of choices might I want? What would matter to me? Because I know for me, you know, cars just wouldn't be a very big deal. And I know for an awful lot of people who've gone through the experience of organizing a funeral, you know, that feeling of being handed the sort of IKEA coffin catalog, you know, like, which coffin do you want? And you think, I've never, you know, I don't really want a coffin. I want this not to be happening. And so the whole approach with Poppy's is about really trying to bring that humanity to this moment in life. So we care hugely about the stuff that you buy. Of course, we want the coffin to be beautiful and the vehicles to be beautiful, but we much more understand our impact to be around the how that we do it. So obvious things that sound so obvious, but that are a bit lacking in the sector. So just giving you abundant time and making sure you're equipped with all the right information so that the choices you make are genuinely right for you. You know, we're not fitting you into our diary. We are trying to build something that will be useful to you. And that's what we've seen. So we've looked after about 3,000 families, communities over the last 10 years. And that's what we see. And that's what we hear back from people, that to be cared for well around that time can be a really helpful foundational pillar of that kind of beginning of the grief journey, I guess.
That sounds so obvious. And you express the whole thing so beautifully. I love what you say about death and dying and how we need to acknowledge it more and incorporate it more. That's what we're all about here, I suppose. But yes, the business of the funeral planning does sound so obvious, because you're having to deal with a huge variety of people with different feelings, different wishes, different turbulences.
Yeah. And not making assumptions about what's right. So I think for whatever reason, the sector's quite paternalistic, you know, and I think the intentions are good. You know, I think it's this idea of, in my head, I'm quite visual, and I feel the sector kind of treats the grieving person like sort of like they're their dear, you know, sort of, you know, poor you with your weeping, and we'll sort of do everything and you can sort of come. And my understanding of grief is very different, you know, that of course nobody who's grieving wants to be burdened with, you know, endless to-do lists, but there's something about the thinking and the doing and the engaging in the process of organizing a funeral, particularly if it's meaningful, but can be healing, actually, you know, to have the time to think carefully about what would be right for your family or your community is a really tangible step in facing what's coming next. And just sort of some examples. So, and it's the modern world. So, you know, supporting a family where a parent has died and the children are still young, you know, that often a very core priority there will be, how can we organize something, not just the day of the funeral, but all the experiences around the death and the days after the death, designed around the children's needs, you know. So if those children are 3 or if those children are 13, will be really different. There'll be really different needs. So we've had funerals for parents of young children where, you know, the whole funeral has been designed with small people in mind. So whether that be making sure that there's ample space on the front where little children can sit on cushions, and maybe there's lots of fairy lights, and maybe there's poetry that they'll be familiar with, or stories from school that they'll be familiar with. Not making assumptions about the extent to which young children will want to engage with the body. So I think we've got this sort of stiff upper lip idea that the body is inherently scary and dangerous, and, you know, small children need to be kept away from the dead. But small children they haven't yet learnt to be afraid of the dead, you know. So if there is somebody who's died, maybe it's a friend of theirs, not making the assumption that they wouldn't want to see them, you know, that seeing them and seeing that they've died could be a really crucial step for those young children in understanding what's happened. Or right at the other end of the spectrum, we did a funeral for a family where the man who died's mum had quite advanced dementia, and he was quite a well-known person, and there was this idea that she would feel deeply overwhelmed coming to the funeral, you know, that it would just be too many people and too much. And I feel like in the old days, or, you know, some funeral directors, it would just be like they'd just be excluded, whereas what we did was we basically replayed the funeral, but with sort of 4 people present. So in a different space that was small, but it meant that she was part of the funeral. We just did it again in order that she could get what she needed. And so it's those kinds of, I mean, those are kind of quite extreme examples, but it's that kind of thinking that we bring to our work, that, you know, you are unique and your circumstances are unique, and we're here to help you achieve something. We're not here to process you.
So you're talking about 2 unique identities, aren't you, really? The person who's died and the people around them. And sometimes you must meet some families who don't always agree about what they want. That must complicate things.
Yeah, I think there's 2, I have 2 thoughts on that. One is that's really common and normal, and most families will have a bit of that, you know. And so I think we're pretty good at helping steer people through that, encouraging people to figure out what really matters to them, and then to sort of maybe compromise on the things that, you know, classic group dynamics, really, you know, that say you've got 4 siblings, it's likely they'll all care about different parts of the funeral. And so trying to allow each other to own something, you know, and be more compromising on other things. There is a stage we sometimes get to where we will sort of say, you know, you need to go away and have more conversations and come back when you're ready, because the reality is, you know, if that's been a sort of multi-generational issue, you know, we're not going to resolve it in the days leading up to the funeral. So we also sometimes need to be very boundaried and say, you know, we can't progress until you've made sort of these 3 decisions and come back when you have. And that could be useful too.
And you mentioned fear about death, both from children and from adults. I think, yes, there's a great deal of fear. I think that's why we don't talk about it enough, isn't it? Because we're so afraid of it happening to those we loved, but we're also afraid of our own death and what that might bring. But I also feel that we're afraid of funeral directors. We're afraid, yes, of going to the funeral care homes.
Yeah. I don't think they help themselves by dressing. Like, I just went to see A Christmas Carol at the Old Vic, which was absolutely fabulous. And obviously remembering how many of Dickens' novels are that have undertakers in them and how completely understandably, I mean, actually the undertaker in A Christmas Carol is a really jovial man, but, you know, that I think that was a very Victorian pastiche, this idea of the funeral director being this sort of bringer of death and kind of money grabber. You know, it's sort of got some really nasty, and funeral directors, I'm not saying they model themselves as businesses, but they model themselves superficially in that, still in that way, don't they, of kind of the tails and the hat and the marching and the cane. And I don't think that helps. I think it's really wonderful to be able to put on any kind of superficial garb in order to meet the family's needs. And so we absolutely will put on a hat if that's what people want. But I think presenting yourself professionally in that way means that most people only go into the funeral directors when they absolutely have to. We're just opening a new shop on the high street in Sheen. And the whole thinking behind it is, how can we create space where people feel they want to come in when they don't need to? You know, that they would come in to have a conversation about death, you know, in the model of, for example, things like Death Cafe, you know, which are changing the way we in society, we realize we can, and maybe it would be helpful to talk about death before it's kind of pressing in on us. And very much the space we're trying to build is one where, both through the people there and the look of the space, it's like, come in and talk to us, come and have coffee. Whereas I think the way most funeral directors present themselves, with the blinds in the window and the stonemasonry and the outfits, it feels like, I'll go in there when I need to buy something, but I won't go in there until that happens. And that's, it's such a missed opportunity.
So how do you think you'll get people to come in?
Well, we've got 10 years of experience of that in Tooting, which is our first site, although it's a little different because it's our first time on the high street. I think the way we land is really important. So the poppy sort of brand colour is this beautiful bright dahlia, and the entire outside of the space is going to be that colour. So I think it's going to surprise people. And I think that's quite helpful. You know, I think there'll be a sense of like, oh, what's this? The language we use. So we worked quite hard on creating language that provokes people into this discussion and in a gentle way. So the language is not, you know, come and buy a funeral plan. It's, have you ever thought about this before? It's really normal to have questions. We're going to have kind of Friday coffee mornings. We're going to run death cafes and events. But the way we model ourselves as a business already is very much about informing yourself in good time. So we have a blog called Talking Death, which is all about talking about death and dying and grief. And I use it all the time. So someone will message me just in my personal life to say, you know, my dad's just had this diagnosis and we're really afraid. And I will send them sort of three or four links from the blog of, you know, it's not about the funeral. It's about conversations you could have now or resources that might be available out there. So I think it's about trying to, I've always had this idea of death care being this chain with lots of, you know, interlinking bits of the chain. And I think, so historically, or at least for the last sort of 50 years, because we're all kind of putting off these discussions, it's all been quite isolated. And I think the hospice movement have done a really, really good job of showing what's possible when you take a more holistic approach. And very much at Poppies, that's our model, you know, which is, we know we do the best job when people come to us sooner rather than later, as is so often true in healthcare as well, that we can get to know you, we can make sure you have what you need. I'm thinking of a woman who called once, this was years ago, and I could see she was whispering, and she was, I think, full of shame. And what she was saying was, you know, my dad is dying in the room next door. You know, I'm in the kitchen and he's in the living room, and he's going to die in the next week. And when he dies, you know, what if he dies in the middle of the night? Like, I want to know what to do, but I feel terrible for calling because I feel like I'm somehow disrespecting him or maybe bringing this on us. And it was so much my job to say, what you're doing is so responsible and so wise, you know, that you're, it will happen, and it will be so helpful if you already know the people who are going to come and you already have a plan, you know, so that if someone dies in the night, lots of people assume the funeral directors have to come in the night. And that's not true. You could, if you wanted to, you could keep your person at home for a little bit. And these are just tiny anecdotes to kind of communicate this sense of, you know, so much of the fear can be addressed by, through information, not all of it, but an awful lot of the anxiety can be addressed through making sure people feel informed and supported and held.
And these are exactly the kind of things we do need to know, because if somebody does die in the middle of the night, I'm assuming one would think one has to phone somebody.
Yeah.
But you're saying No.
Well, you have to, the death needs to be verified. So you would call the doctor or whoever the out of hours person was to come and verify the death. But it is challenging and disrupting this idea of the emergency of death, you know, that actually once the death has happened, the emergency is over. And this is possibly the first opportunity for peace that you might have had in a very long time. and trying to, and historically, you know, we've understood this better. And I think that's what we've lost in the sort of go, and the this process becoming clinical, is that we have our to-do list. And sometimes it's even the case, we've heard this from families, of the doctor will come to verify the death, and they'll, before they leave, they'll say, have you called the funeral director? You know, which is, again, the intention is good. It's like, I want to feel like I'm handing you over to the next person. But the danger for the family is that they misunderstand and think that there are some sort of bureaucratic things they need to do. And before they know it, their dad is, you know, on some industrial estate in a body bag at the funeral director's, and it doesn't have to be that way. And some of the most amazing experiences we've supported have been in those hours and days after death, when someone's been able to die at home, and the family, in a way that I completely relate to, have thought, rather than coming to see them 2 weeks later, kind of like embalmed at a building we don't know, why don't we just spend time with him now? You know, and lovely stories and things we've got to be a part of singing and cups of tea and slices of cake and saying the things you wanted to say and, you know, bringing the neighbours over. There's so much possibility, and we just don't know too much about it these days. Yeah. I think there's it's like lots of these things. I think what we've been shown around death, if you think of TV and popular media, is like people turning into zombies kind of, you know, on the strike of 12. And obviously that's not how science works. That's not how nature works. If you've ever, you know, watching the autumn leaves now, nothing suddenly happens. Things happen gradually. But if you took a photo from, you know, August and now, you'd say, oh, a lot has changed. And the body is the same. So there are changes that start to happen, but they've been happening even pre-death, you know, because the process of dying, it's not, you're not fully alive and then fully dead. You're dying, and then that process continues. So just very practically, if someone was staying at home and it was the middle of summer, you know, or it was a home where they kept the heating very, very high, if a family said, you know, we want to keep our dad at home for a few days, we would say, you know, keep the room cool. And if they were keeping them home, you know, for a few days or longer, we'd say, use sort of ice packs and lay them over the body in order to keep the person cool. So it's very, very practical, simple things. I think because we've become so unfamiliar with death, even sometimes in healthcare, I think there can be a sense of emergency when, you know, there's absolutely no reason in the minutes or hour after someone's died to quickly turn the heating to cold, because nothing's going to suddenly happen. You know, that's what we do a lot of, is we're going to do this thing. This is why we're doing it. It doesn't mean this, in case you're worried, you know, carry on. So I think all of us, you know, again, throughout that trajectory of kind of healthcare to way beyond to bereavement support and just how we support people who are grieving in a community, I think, yeah, there's a step forward we need to make, which is, again, I think fear is what holds us back.
And going back to going into the funeral directors, I think one of the things that we are all afraid of, which we've talked about before, but I think we're afraid of that obsequiousness that seems to go with funeral care homes, doesn't it? And from what the way you talk, I'm sure you're not, I know you're not like that, but what why does that have to happen?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know the answers, because that, you know, I didn't come up through that world, but I always try and keep a really compassionate, open heart. You know, it's easy, isn't it? I hear stories of things that families have been through, and I'm filled with rage. And it's like trying to step away from that edge of, because it's not helpful. There will be a reason why. I think it's a combination of things. I think it's a lot about fear. So my understanding of sort of paternalism is that it comes from a sense of, you are vulnerable. You are the kind of vulnerable party, and I am the one with more power. And it's my job to like make everything okay for you and make it better for you. And I think when not practiced well, or when you try and turn that quality into a kind of process, operational process, it very quickly turns into a sort of inauthentic script. And that, you know, we know that's true with love too, right? That's why when you get handed a kind of bunch of like plastic roses on Valentine's Day, it's like the most offensive thing. You'd rather have nothing. So when I see it happen in the sector, what I think I'm seeing is often a sort of male approach, which is, my job is to make this all okay. The way to make it all okay is to kind of sugarcoat it, or make sure I don't say any words that hurt you, or maybe not even fully tell you the truth, because I'm scared if I tell you the truth, you'll be upset. You know, if I use the word dead, maybe that'll upset you. So I'm going to use the word passed away, or I'm so scared of getting your husband's name wrong that I'm just going to keep calling him your loved one or the deceased, because I got those words in my head, and I know if I use those words, like, I can't do any damage, is the thinking. And at its sharp end, it leads to really bad stuff. So we quite often hear stories of funeral directors or even the hospital telling a family that they cannot see the person who's died because the condition of the body is, you know, unviewable. This is some of the language you hear, which is ridiculous. You know, the idea that this is not the funeral director's or the hospital's call. This is a family decision. This is a community decision. The body is not owned by the funeral director. It is your job as a funeral director to have a conversation with the family or the community to make sure they understand what they're going to experience. And there is a way of doing that with deep emotional intelligence, no matter what the condition of the person who's died. But quite often we'll collect somebody from a hospital where another, you know, maybe the family have come to us because this first funeral director told them they couldn't see their son and he's absolutely fine. You know, there's something about his body that the funeral director have decided is that might upset someone, which is like, he's dead. You know, people are upset. We're not here to save people from being upset. So I think there's lots of bits to it, but I think it's a combination of inappropriately trying to solve things when actually the acceptance of the person who works in the hospice or the bereavement counsellor or the funeral director should be, the death has happened. I can't fix that. I can make sure this isn't any worse than it needs to be. There might be opportunities here for healing. My job is to see if I can possibly create those, but it's absolutely not a given. And I think what you sometimes see in the funeral sector is this kind of like, you know, which I think is quite a male, you know, I feel bad for men that they sometimes carry this responsibility of like, I've got to make it all better. It's like, you absolutely can't. And maybe in accepting that, we have a better chance of being useful.
And from my point of view, I would like somebody who responds to me.
Yeah.
So sort of spends a minute or two assessing on what sort of range of upsetness I am and whether I am the kind of person who actually just wants to deal with this quietly on my own or whether I want that kind of obsequiousness. I mean, there probably are some people who find that quite reassuring and others
maybe. I don't know. My sense is, I mean, I agree there's a spectrum. You know, I remember the man who came into Poppy's and said, you know, I want to be in and out of here in 15 minutes. Can you do that? And it was like, absolutely, we can. You know, we just flew through the paperwork and off he went. And so I think there's absolutely anyone who's providing a service, their job is to be, you know, treat the person who's coming in like an individual and meet their needs. But I think obsequiousness has no integrity, you know, because it's fake by its very nature. It's not real. So, and I think that's interesting that actually, without getting too heavy, for those people who don't want to keep themselves to themselves, for those people who are hurting and it's out, I guess that can sometimes be quite scary, you know, and the funeral sector has developed a kind of script in order to manage it. And I don't think that's very helpful.
No, I think that's exactly what's wrong. And you've described it all so well. It feels frightening. It feels scary. And most of us are not used to going into the shops on the high street. We walk straight past them, don't we? So yeah. All power to your elbow. I hope you're...
Thank you.
Encourages people to come in and talk about the whole thing from the beginning, like you say, about talking about the possibility that we are all going to die and that we are going to lose our loved ones long before it happens, so we don't have these regrets afterwards, which so many of us are left with. But going on to another element of your care, I know you care about the environment and the planet, don't you? And that's a great concern for lots of people nowadays, isn't it? How to have the best environmentally friendly funeral.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, that starts for me in the place of, you know, we should die the way we live, you know, so it seems a real terrible shame if you're someone who has really made a commitment to the planet through your lifetime and then your funeral hasn't had that thought put into it, particularly because it's like the last step. So for me, that actually, although I care hugely about the planet, you know, we don't market ourselves as a green funeral directors, and we're very mindful of how, because we don't think about death, what we really don't want to be doing is like shaming people into making decisions that aren't what they want at that last moment. So we'd never say, you must do this, or, okay, well, you can do that, but you know what that means. So for us, that comes from a place of, you know, we can help you have an experience that is in keeping with how you've lived. And for more and more people, considering the environmental legacy as part of that. There hasn't been a lot of research into, you know, really good granular research into what choices are better than others, but there has been some. So what we know, I mean, it's sort of obvious, is, you know, recycled wooden or paper coffin is going to be better for the planet than a chipboard coffin with MDF and kind of veneer on the outside, which is what most people buy. And so at Poppy's, we sell this thing lovely called a Life Art coffin, which looks very, very similar to the sort of traditional, you know, the thing you'd expect to see in the back of a hearse, sort of looks like wood, but is actually chipboard, kind of looks like metal handles, but are actually plastic because they're going to go in the cremator. So we've got something which is a very similarly priced. And just in the last year or two, we've gone from selling mostly these kind of the worst environmental type of coffin, because that's what people want, to the best. And that's a really good example that, you know, I think for funeral directors for a long time, green funerals have been a kind of like sales move to kind of buy a green funeral, you know, and buy this kind of expensive willow coffin. And I don't like that. You know, I feel like sustainable choices should be normal and they should be for everyone. So it's been really exciting to find this product that replaces the traditional thing with something that is so much better for the planet.
Can you just tell me again what it's made of? I didn't quite follow.
So it's made of, I'm going to get all the words wrong now, but it's basically recycled paper and card. But I think it's pulped in a way to make it look, so it looks like a beauty, looks like the sort of traditional wooden coffin you'd see in the back of a hearse. And that's been key, because I think up until now, green funerals have been a sort of almost like a superficial choice, or they can be a superficial choice. You know, people think of a green funeral like something that's pretty and it's sort of willow and there's wild flowers. And I love that. But that's different to kind of what actual impact is this having. So it's very exciting now to start to get some products that tick the boxes for the families that want that traditional look, but are just still affordable and still better for the planet. One really interesting thing, though, that I want to squeeze in is there is, I think, still much debate. So I think there's a perception that cremation must be much worse for the planet because it's using gas and creating, obviously, carbon dioxide. But the research that's been done, because I think this is important for people who are making these decisions, it's all context. So, for example, natural burial is absolutely the best decision. So you're buried, you know, not too deep, sort of 3 feet down, often on land that is not heavily, you know, it's managed, but it's not heavily, it's not lots of mowing and pesticides and things like that. But if you live in London, your closest natural burial grounds are a drive away. And so the research that has been done has shown, you know, whilst a local cremation might be a kind of immediate tax on the planet, the equivalent of kind of getting 40 people to drive to the natural burial ground and back, and possibly kind of more car journeys over time, it's not necessarily a better choice for the planet. So when it comes to choices for your body, it's still the case that, you know, it's much of a muchness and you should do what feels right to you. The message we're always trying to send at Poppies is, you know, do small things. So for example, embalming is a really good example. Embalming is a, you know, uses formaldehyde. It's a very, very invasive process. And some funeral directors are embalming 50 to 60% of people. And that's mostly happening because it suits the funeral director's model. So funeral directors will have their high street shops and then they'll often have a kind of offsite mortuary. And families don't necessarily know that. So the family might assume the person is being kept in the high street shop. But it's highly likely that if you want to see them, they'll have to be driven from the mortuary to the shop. And they'll probably stay there for a day or so. And there may not be any refrigeration in the shop. So none of this is explained to you. That the experience for the customer will often be, you know, I want to organise a funeral, and the funeral director will say, do you think you're going to want to see your dad? And if you say yes or maybe, there's a good chance they'll say, well, we recommend embalming or even hygienic treatment, as it's sometimes called. And so you just don't know, you don't know any of the logistics involved. So 50 to 60%, some funeral directors are embalming, and at Poppies, it's less than 1%. So that's a really good example of something that I don't think most people want embalming. I think it's sold to people. And that's just like a small act that you can make in order to kind of lessen your impact on the planet.
And what about wicker coffins? You just said something that surprised me. You said wicker coffins are expensive. I thought people took them as a sort of cheaper, greener option.
They are. I mean, they are, I think they're the most beautiful. So, you know, if you buy a willow coffin that's grown in Somerset, woven in Somerset, it probably is about twice the price of your kind of traditional, you know, MDF veneer coffin. There are lovely bamboo and willow coffins that you can buy that are more affordable, but they're often sort of grown and woven in Poland or China. And again, we're back now to the kind of, you know, six of one, half dozen of another. So there are, you know, when people come to us and say, you know, we want the greenest choices, and we even have a function on our website that kind of shows you what the greenest choices are, we can do that. But I think one of the things we're mindful of at Poppies is people are often coming with quite a lot of conflicting needs and priorities. So there might be cultural needs or religious needs, or my brother is just absolutely determined that we're going to do this, you know. And so what we're trying to say is, there are still lots of small ways you can do positive things for the planet, and don't think of a green funeral as this thing that you buy and it's a package and it costs this. Think of this as a kind of series of decisions. And, you know, you might have a traditional classic hearse that runs on diesel, but the flowers might have been grown in your neighbor's garden, you know, and every small act is a kind of positive act.
Really interesting. So I'm going to end now, Poppy, by asking you, what is it like being you, waking up every morning, knowing you're going to deal with death and knowing that you're going to be dealing with people's sadness? I can't quite get my head around that.
I how do I seem?
Very jolly.
So joyful. It's so, I'm not suggesting that the experience of caring for grieving people is joyful, but, you know, most of us in life are looking for meaning and purpose. And I certainly was. And this is work where it's very tangible, you know, the impact you're having on people, the doors you're able to open for people are very, very tangible. And I love it so much. And I think there's lots of, again, context to that. So I've built a really, really supportive, brilliant team. And those, you know, I did it by myself at the beginning, and that was hard. And I wouldn't, you know, that's the nature of the beginning of things, but I never wanted to continue in that way. So having a community of people who, I guess, we have shared values and we have a shared vision around normalizing great care. And that's very inspiring. Yeah, I've done other jobs and they weren't nearly so inspiring or kind of wonderful as this. So it's really good.
You seem to be saying it's rewarding. And I suppose I can identify with that because of everything you've talked about, looking after people so carefully and knowing that they've had the best experience must be.
Yeah, and the selfish, you know, those of us who've got into kind of helping others, you know, whatever that means, you know, teachers and nurses and all of us, parents and carers of elderly parents, I think there's something about stepping towards those parts of life that are hidden in darkness, because maybe by learning more about them or by inspecting them in more detail, they'll turn out to be less scary than they seem. I know that that's the way my brain works, you know, that it's better for me to know, because then that kind of quiets the imagination. So I think there's a selfish piece too, which is there's something about being with the dead and being with grieving people that reassures probably some anxiety in me about, like, yes, this is coming. And when it comes, there are wonderful people who can help. And there are ways of navigating this that are healthy and hard, but supported. And so that's probably, you know, a piece of it as well. And I think that's one of the, I'm not the only one, we're not the only ones, but there is something about, someone said something to me the other day, because we do these open days where we bring people into the mortuary and, you know, you can ask any questions and it's lovely because there's, you know, there's like 30 people lined up on benches and the fridges are in the background. We, you know, we obviously don't get any dead people out, but like you're in the company of death and it feels very kind of like revolutionary, really. Yeah, no, because people are like, what's happening in these buildings? You know, it's so hidden from view. And someone said to me, sort of challenged me and said, I was sort of saying how I felt that it was an act of kind of engaging with our mortality. And someone said to me, you know, I think it takes more than meeting a funeral director or whatever to make friends with your mortality. And they're right. But I also thought there's so little, because we can talk about grief and we can talk about the emotions, but there's something about the practical that makes it real, you know, and because of the world we live in now, it's so rare to see the dead body or to be in the company of the dead body. The dead have become so taboo. So I think there is something quite specific about being a funeral director or working with the dead body, you know, which is, this is it, you know, this is what it is. It's nothing more, it's nothing less. You know, for me, that's really, it just pops all those bubbles of terror to be like, this is John, you know, John is dead. He's quite clearly dead. You know, it doesn't feel to me there's any ghosts around, you know, his body's fine as it is, nothing suddenly happening. So yeah, I think it can be a really useful thing to come and do. It's rare to get the chance, isn't it? We could do so much better, couldn't we?
Thank you very much for talking to us.
We'll be having more chats in future episodes about everything to do with death and dying, such as how to prepare for it, what it's really like when someone dies, how to talk about it, what kind of plans to make, how different cultures and faiths approach dying and bereavement, lots more around grief and loss, how to support others in their sadness, and my personal hobby horse, How to Rebuild a Life, a Good Life, After the Loss of Someone Special. If you'd like to join us to talk about the death of someone near to you, if this episode has resonated with you and you have a story to share, or if you've been affected by some of the issues raised, please do get in touch at hello@livingwithdying.co.uk.